When it comes to compact construction equipment, Takuchi is a globally trusted brand. The famous red and grey machines you see everywhere are built to perform on any site, delivering power, precision, comfort and reliability from 1 to 15 tons. Now offering a lineup of proven compact track loaders, versatile tool carriers for construction and highways. Choose machines that work as hard as you do. Visit Takuchi-mfg.co.uk to find out more.
It's Wednesday, the 7th of January, 2026, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. And a happy new year to all our listeners and to you, Phil. Happy new year.
Thank you, David. Happy new year to you. Although it feels like a week into the new year, we kind of stopped saying that right now.
Yeah, I think we had a similar discussion at the beginning of last year, actually. We're still saying Happy New Year by February. But it all seems in distant past now. But you were, last time we recorded a podcast, you were pretty ill, I seem to remember, and you fought manfully through it.
I had some sort of cold, flu. I don't think it was COVID. I'd had the COVID jab, had the flu jab, but anyway, yeah, it was. I was quite rough for a couple of days, but it just took me about 3 weeks to be back to, you know, full fighting fitness. Mm. And lots of people in my neck of the woods have been saying exactly the same thing. They may have been ill for a week, yeah, but a month before they actually felt ready to, back on games.
Yeah, well, my wife, who's a teacher, came back, brought something horrible back from school, like teachers tend to.
Schools are almost as bad as hospitals, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They're just breeding grounds. But she's finally back to normal, just in time to get back to work as well. So she'll probably come back with something else exotic soon. Anyway, so we've got some things to talk about, some interesting topics. What do you want to kick off with, Phil?
There's a couple of, one very important, very interesting report from the government, and another pretty interesting, probably in the grand scheme of things less important, because it's yet another bloody thing of the same thing, which we've had a million of, from the government. And finally, we're going to talk about an interesting newish job title that seems to have emerged in some of the boardrooms in the construction industry, and try and get our head around that. But let's start off with the week before Christmas, December the 17th, the government published its proposals for a single construction regulator. Mm. Now, this is all on the back of the Grenfell Tower fire, which was 8.5 years ago now, wasn't it?
That is astonishing, isn't it?
And the ramifications are still running through. If you remember, was it November 23 or 24? Sorry, 24 it would have been, wouldn't it?
24 it was.
Official inquiry published its report. We talked about that at length, reported on at length. And one of the recommendations of that was, of the official inquiry, the second report or the final report of the official inquiry into Grenfell Tower fire, was that there should be a single construction regulator. And the government, it says that it is acting on and accepting all the recommendations of the report, sort of, up to a point. I mean, it's not absolutely doing everything it says. But, and this is part of the follow-up to the government enacting, or seeking to enact, the Grenfell inquiry's recommendation for a single construction regulator. It talks about buildings, and to make a regulator to ensure that buildings are safe, a regulator to ensure that building products are safe and fit for purpose and the right ones are being used, and a regulator to ensure that the people doing it are competent. So it's buildings, products and people. And first few things are interesting, but the one I think is particularly new here, because this is where it's going further than the it's talking about going further than the Martin Moore Bick and the chairman of the inquiry, his recommendations. He gave the prospectus, the consultation paper, is suggesting that it's not just going to be building control and fire safety where the government needs to intervene, But they're basically saying all built environment professions are now going to be state regulated. Now, my first job in journalism, one of my first jobs, was working for New Civil Engineer magazine when it was owned by the Institution of Civil Engineers. So I'm moderately au fait with how the Institution of Civil Engineers works. And it essentially, for the past, I want to say 250 years, I'm not sure how exactly how old it is, but certainly a couple of hundred years, I believe, has regulated the civil engineering profession. Similarly, the Institution of Structural Engineers, it sets out the template of, defines what you need to know, what you need to be able to do to call yourself a member of the Institution of Civil Engineers. And if you get really good, you become a fellow of the Institution of Civil Engineers. Although, typically, like all professional institutions, I suspect that the bar has lowered slightly because it wants to get, you know, people all around the world into civil engineering, to become members and pay their subs. I know of outside of the construction industry, I know one particular professional institution which has said, we want to, you know, got a new chief executive, we're going to, I can't remember, say double or treble our membership within the next 5 years. So they're doing that, giving membership away to various countries of Africa. And it's become a complete nonsense. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of competent people in Africa, but they're not the ones who are being given this, you know, membership of this official institution. So,
Is there a suggestion then, Phil, that these institutions, you know, these royal institutions, in many cases, are dumbing down and they're sort of giving into the commercial imperative?
This is not exactly what the government consultation paper says, but if I can just find, here's a quote. While many of those in the sector, talking about professional bodies, are already working to high standards, the current system of regulation and oversight is too complex and fragmented to provide public confidence that this is always the case. No single body has a full view of competence, capacity, regulation and enforcement across the building regulations. While some areas are regulated in statute, most are self-regulated or not regulated at all. Where professional bodies do provide oversight, these can vary in terms of legal status, governance and public interest functions. There is also no consistent definition or enforcement of competence or standards for public accountability. This is despite significant endeavours for many in the industry to drive skills and competence. As a result, there is generally insufficient recognition and benefit for those who do the right thing, and limited consequences for those who do not, with wider implications for skills, development and overall productivity. So they're not saying there's dumbing down going on. What they are saying is, we think it would be better if there was state control. The whole business of self-regulation, self-certification, and this all goes back to Grenfell, where the people who sold the cladding put a badge on it, said, "Yeah, go ahead, use that. We've certified it because we slipped the certification bodies a few bob while they weren't looking, and they gave us a badge, absolutely meaningless badge as it turned out."
Yeah, which did happen.
So, and I think the suggestion is that your professional, you know, chartered engineer badge from whichever institution you get it, is perhaps as meaningless as your product certification badge from whoever hands those out, because, you know, third party certification, whatever.
It's a huge change to suggest, isn't it?
Mega. The interesting thing is, the Martin Moore-Bick's recommendations after the Grenfell fire, he said that building product testing and certification should be nationalised, that the government or a government organisation should be in charge of testing and handing out badges to say, yeah, you pass. The government, rightly, for all sorts of good reasons, balked at that, said, no, that doesn't make sense. We need to keep a tighter eye on the accreditation bodies, the certification bodies. We need to make sure they're doing the right thing. But they have a valuable role still to play. So while they've backed away from nationalising product certification, they're basically bringing under, they're proposing, they're talking about, they're flying the kite of, and I don't think you'll get beyond this kite flying, but at the moment they're flying the kite of bringing control of what it, you know, what should a structural engineer, a building services engineer of professional status, what should they look like? What should they know? What should they be able to do? That job has always been done by the institutions, the professional bodies. The government's saying, no, we're going to have central control of it. And my reaction to that is, yikes. Because if you want something done properly, you don't get the government to do it. I mean, just off what I put out there, that one word.
Okay, fair enough. Say no more, I mean, I think we could expect some fairly hefty pushback from the institutions, you know, because this is a prospectus. They want people to respond and give suggestions about what they think about this. I think we can expect a pretty strong pushback from the profession institutions, can't we? None of them are going to want to relinquish their status, let alone their responsibility.
I wonder how many senior civil servants involved in all of this actually have any kind of professional qualification. Apart from maybe odd Mickey Mouse one.
An accountant or a lawyer amongst them, I suppose. But professional status is jealously guarded, isn't it, by these organisations and by their members. And I agree with you. I think that by putting under centralised government control, there's less of a vested interest, if you like, in Whitehall than there is in, say, I don't know, Great George Street for the Institution of Civil Engineers.
Now, it may not go as far. There is a step before state control of determining what these things are. We talked recently, I can't remember if it was in our last pod or last month, month before, we talked about the Architects Registration Board, ARB, which is separate from REBA and was set up, and I was surprised how recently it was set up. I can't remember what it was, but we did talk about that before. It was set up relatively recently to ensure that architects were, you know, competent, that their buildings weren't going to fall down. And on the back of the Grenfell Tower fire fallout, we've always already had the building control profession put in that now has a different status. But the ARB is not government controlled so much as set up by statute. There is an Act of Parliament that controls it. It has a legal framework behind it in a way that, you know, ICE or iStruct D don't have. So building control and architects have already moved away from self-regulation to an extent.
Sure.
Now, it could be that they're going to say there will be an ARB-type body for chartered engineers, but within that, whether it's building services or civils or structurals, whatever, they'll have to follow into line. No suggestion that mechanical engineers would it, because they're not thought of as built environment, although often you get mechanical engineers who become SIBSE members as well. But anyway, it's a long document. This 56-page document on .gov.uk website. Look, it's called Single Construction Regulator Prospectus. And I was chatting to a chartered surveyor mate of mine, and I was saying, have you seen this? Is it what they're suggesting? He says, oh no, it's only for fire engineers and building control, isn't it? It's not for real engineers and surveyors and us, you know, because we're a very long standing RICS, decades.
Well, that's
And I said, well, there are certain comments in there that I think, you know, you might want to look at again, because I think it's going a lot further than you. It's talking about all professions within the built environment.
Within the built environment,
You know, that they're talking about coming under the new single construction regulator. And a single construction regulator ultimately, it's probably going to have to mark the exam papers, you know, say who passes or fail if you take it to its logical conclusion. That ain't going to happen. I mean, it cannot happen. It's a nonsense. But that's essentially the end game of what they're talking about in this paper. And so anyway, he went back to it and said, oh, Thanks, Phil. That's another 3 hours CPD I've just done studying that.
But I'm going back to the ARB. I hadn't realised that the I don't know when the ARB was set up, but I hadn't realised it was that recent. I mean, why was the ARB set up in the first place? What was the REBA not doing that they had to invent ARB to do? I mean, because that might provide a model for other bodies, as you suggest. You know, there might be one, an equivalent for the structural engineers and the civil engineers, etc., etc.
Okay, the ARB, I've just done a quick Google, was set up in 1997 under the 1997 Architects Act, which protects the it maintains a list of registered architects, and it makes sure that people don't call themselves architects when they're not. It provides legal restriction for the title architect in a way that engineer doesn't have. I took a photo of it, actually. I thought it would come in useful one day to illustrate an article. I don't know whether it was. It wasn't even a lift out of say, I think it's a broken window. Somewhere I saw, and a little handwritten sign saying, engineer on their way.
Yes. Well, my father was fairly sensitive about that sort of language as well. He was a member of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. He was an aeronautical engineer, in fact. But he always balked when a heating engineer would come around to service the boiler and stuff like
that. Yes,
Or an engineer would service his car.
But no, I think if I was the Institution of Civil Engineers, if it looked like this was a losing battle, I would ensure that the quid pro quo was what the architects got and say, legal protection of the word engineer, please. Chartered engineer is protected, but that doesn't mean anything to anyone.
No, that's right. I mean, I think the average man or woman in the street wouldn't really know the difference between an engineer and a chartered engineer. Probably means, letters after his name.
Yeah. But anyway, it's interesting. In conclusion, what I should say is what happens next. This spring, the government's publishing a call for evidence to seek detailed views on the single construction regulator prospectus in the round, including licensing for contractors who put up tall buildings. So, which is talked about what the Federation of Master Builders want. They want conservatory erectors to have licenses. That's very different. You'd be able to put up a school, but you can't put up a conservatory or a tall building, so you haven't got a license. Go figure. That comes out in the spring. And then in spring 2027, so in whatever, 15 months' time, the built environment professions paper, what their strategy, what they're going to do, how they're going to regulate the built environment professions will come out in spring 2027. So if you are a construction professional, if you want to be a construction professional, or if you've got a grudge against construction professionals, you've got 15 months to respond to all of this and explain to the government why, frankly, this is ludicrous and there must be a better way forward.
Yeah. Why are they announcing that they're going to publish a call for evidence in spring 2026? Isn't this prospectus effectively the same thing? Because normally somebody will put out a consultation document and as soon as it's published, they'll welcome remarks and contributions. Why are they waiting until the spring?
Well, there used to be something called green papers and white papers, which was green papers are simply, as I say, flying a kite, and a white paper saying, okay, we've talked to people and this is where we think we're at. This is where we're going. I think to publish something so ginger as what they've done in December 2026, so long after the fire itself, does seem snail's pace movement.
Well, yeah. So we've got to wait until the spring to find out.
Well, spring 2027, really, for the future professions. In spring 2026 is going to be a. Well, I think they're asking for. I think they're inviting comments from, let me have a look at this. I'm sure they're inviting comments from, they're inviting comments from what they're calling the Single Construction Regulator Prospectus Consultation Document. And then the call for evidence is a separate thing. So I don't understand quite what the difference is between the prospectus and the call for evidence.
No, that's no, I don't.
I presume it'll move it forward. I'm not sure. We'll have to watch this space. But all interesting. The one thing we haven't mentioned that has been established in post-Grenfell and in the wake of regulation, apart from building control having been coming to the building safety regulator for tall buildings, higher risk buildings, it's the Fire Engineers Advisory Panel. Fire Engineers Advisory Panel was established April last year to provide advice to the government on fire engineering. So things are happening on fire engineering as per various Grenfell recommendations. And I think the initial assumption from a lot of people that this is what all fire engineers was only what was going to become involved in the regulation of professions. But no, it's talking about all built environment professions.
Right, okay. Should we move on to our second topic then, Phil, which is also about government initiatives?
Another government...
Government agency.
Another government report, or at least government agency report. Yes, it's the Competition and Markets Authority, which discussed before. I mean, you and I remember it was the Office for Fair Trading and the Competition Commission. They came together whenever it was, 15 years ago, I can't remember, to become the Competition and Markets Authority, which is essentially... exists or used to exist to stop cartels from forming, to ensure that there's free trade, free market competition, and so on and so forth. The Keir Starmer's government last year before, when it first came in, said we'd kind of like the Competition and Markets Authority to be not so much an organisation that impedes mergers and business growth and economic progress. We'd rather like it to encourage and be supportive. So if two big British companies want to come together to defend their side against whatever, American, European, Chinese, most likely, we should let it.
Yes.
We should all be, you know, rah-rah British interests. And in amongst this, it also is using it as a sort of management consultant organisation. And in June last year, it said to the Competition and Markets Authority, again, we've talked about this, we'd like you to look at the civil engineering market, please. Now, as we said before, as soon as you hear this thing, oh my goodness, there must be cartels operating in civil engineering.
Yes.
No, it's not what they're saying. But it's saying, we know that big civil engineering projects have got a tendency to be late and over budget. Could you tell us why, please, and what needs to be done to stop that happening? Now, blow me, we've got the number of reports that have looked into all of this sort of stuff, whether civil engineering or construction more generally. And we've got the National Infrastructure... Okay, I'm finding it hard to keep up. Is it the National Infrastructure Commission? Or is it the new body something else? It's the National Infrastructure... Whatever, the newly merged...
National Infrastructure and Service Transformation Authority.
Is that what it's called?
Is it the National Infrastructure...
That wasn't just the transition body. That's what it's now called, is it, NISTA? Okay. Yes.
Well, I think this is from your report. You said the National Infrastructure and Service Transformation Authority was created in April this year, that's last year, by merging the National Infrastructure Commission, the NIC, and the Infrastructure and Projects
that's
Authority.
Right. Thank
IPA.
You for finding it. That's exactly what I was looking for. But we have had both the National Infrastructure Commission and the Infrastructure and Projects Authority, and we've now got the National Infrastructure and Service Transformation Authority all doing their reports. We've had Latham, we've had Egan, we've had Uncle Tom Cobbley and all doing all these reports over the past 20 years saying, you know, what's wrong with construction? And 9 times out of 10, it comes down to essentially procurement. And we've seen it with defence, heaven help us, and defence has not got its act together on procurement. And we've seen it with construction, with big construction. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the CMA has put out this interim report and it's found that, something needs to be done. It's just called, it's very boring, Civil Engineering Market Study Interim Report. Again, this came out on the same day, week before Christmas, 17th of December 2025. You'd think they had something to hide, wouldn't you? 75 pages long. It's basically a, in broad terms, what do they call it? A desk study. They've looked at the literature,
yeah,
and they quote studies from other people like Boston Consulting Group, who found that of 48 UK road projects, 58% finished late, with an average overrun of 29% when delays occurred, and 27 rail projects, of which 56% finished late, with an average overrun of 27%. There's probably been a report that talks about over budget as well. And they're basically saying, yeah, we've looked at all the evidence and there's a problem. And this is their interim report, and therefore the remainder of the study, they're going to look at, and they're seeking further input from people, looking at exploring ways to create a more stable and predictable funding environment, enabling authorities and suppliers to plan and invest for the long term. Now, I don't think this is so much of a problem in capital works as it is in maintenance projects. We're talking about for potholing. Local authorities don't know what their pothole budget is.
Yeah.
So I think this is more of a problem for maintenance, actually, stable and predictable funding. They're going to look at how to strengthen procurement capability across public bodies. Well, clearly what they need to do is nationalise the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply so that they can ensure that they're not giving away Mickey Mouse purchasing qualifications and we don't have rubbish purchasers.
I mean, obviously, this isn't a new thing. Major infrastructure projects have always run late. And
governments have always commissioned reports into why.
Yeah, exactly. But if they're talking about procurement and what we should do about procurement, I mean, we've mentioned before, we talked about is the regulated asset base model, which was used for Tideway. And also, I think for, was it Heathrow Terminal 5?
Funding. That's how to fund it. I mean, I think we're talking specifically here. Is what I think this is going to lean in towards is how fabulous early contractor involvement is, for one.
In
creating, a la Latham, creating a team of people working together at the outset rather than, which I can understand why that's a good thing. But an awful lot of our problems, including, and I still want to go back to the Scottish school collapse as well as to Grenfell, is while the old adversarial model of the architect or the resident engineer as the client's representative, holding a whip over the contractor and telling them, making sure the contractor does what they're supposed to do, while that adversarial model went out of fashion, was seen as a bad thing. It had an awful lot to recommend it. And with the abolition of that sort of role, that clerk of works, we threw the baby out with the bathwater. But, apart from Professor John Cole, not enough people have been standing up and saying, hang on a minute, the whole design and build thing is not without flaws. And I don't think the CMA have yet suggested that they need to look at the flaws in design and build.
So, Phil, are you saying for the last 30 years the construction industry has been moving in the wrong direction? Latham, you mentioned Latham. His report was in 1996. And that's what sort of really started the ball rolling with all this sort of early contractor involvement and constructing the team and all the rest of it and getting rid of the clerk of works or the resident engineer. Why do you think that getting rid of those roles threw the baby out with the bathwater?
I mean, vested interest, I think, is my summary phrase of that. It's putting people with different vested interests, giving them too much power.
Well, people further down the supply chain.
Someone building something, unless they're building it for themselves, the contractor. To be honest, the contractor developer is the best model. Your Watkin Jones type of person who builds a student digs hall of residence, which they're going to run and they're going to take the income from and they're going to look after and maintain. It's in their interest to build it properly, cost effectively, not necessarily as cheaply as possible, but with the lowest whole life cost. It's in their vested interest. If that developer brings in, Big Contractor Inc. To build it, Big Contractor Inc. is only interested in making as much money as they can. It's in their interest to, yes, to, you know, water down the materials and use dodgy products if they can get away with it, and to get away with whatever they can. That's what's in their interest, to get away with. If they can get away, if they can't get away with it, it's not in their interest, because they don't want to, you know, damage their long term business interests, of course. Which is why,
and so that some people would.
This is where we've got into the whole DBFO. I mean, before there was Latham, there was Design Build Finance Operator, or Design Build Operate Transfer, yes, and those sort of things, which was to give the contractor a vested interest in the performance of the, whether it was a bridge or a building, a vested interest in the structure, to make sure that it was easy and cheap to maintain, but didn't fall apart and did the job. And they would say, okay, that's your. But normally it's a 20-year franchise, or what's the word, license, yeah, yeah, or operating period. So, of course, what they did is they put up buildings that fell apart after 25 years. Like, you know, every electronic good I buy with a 5-year warranty falls apart after 6 years. I mean, it's just the way people, yes, who make things, design things, they're going to fall apart, mm-hmm, just after they no longer have any responsibility for it. Well, anyway, that...
That's a very special skill.
There are benefits to design and build. The constructor has the expertise in how to construct things, and that needs to be harvested, harnessed, taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, if you're a customer and you're buying something, the customer is always right, but the customer needs to have the knowledge. We need intelligent customers. The other thing I haven't mentioned here is the abolition of the privatisation, I should say, of the Property Services Agency, which effectively was abolished. Mm. Sold to bits to Tarmac, as it then was, and bits went to, I think, Pell Fishman got some of the PSA, and you know, bits of the Property Services Agency were all harvested off. So we ceased to have an intelligent client. And that's what basically the Clerk of Works role, as I understand it. Now, I'd love someone to come on next week and tell me, 2 weeks' time, and do this again and tell me why I'm wrong, why I'm stuck in the past. But as I understand it, I'm not saying everything that Latham said, or even anything that Latham said, was wrong. I'm simply saying that we've got to put a bit of bathwater back for the baby.
Well, that's the first time I've heard somebody actually say that. Maybe it's just you're not scared to be politically incorrect, because, I mean, it's been accepted orthodoxy for the last quarter of a century that the way to move forward is to construct this unified team and create partnerships, and you know, everything should be, you know, sort of softened. I don't know, sort of. What I'm saying is that, you know, the idea was that everybody should be
Everybody
should be pulling in the same
direction. It absolutely makes sense. But when it comes to sitting around the harmonious committee table, the person chairing that meeting should be the client, absolutely.
Yeah.
And making sure that when the contractor says, I've got a great idea, that the client has got either the knowledge or someone next to them with the knowledge and the courage, essentially, to stand up to, because normally the contractor's got the money, stands up to the contractor and says, or at least he's got some sort of leverage to contract, and says, yeah, that may look like a great idea, but 10 years down the line, this is the problem that's going to happen. Or it may look like a good idea to not have a clerk of works on site supervising the works, and you supervise the work yourself, but what happens when they don't put in all the ties and the brickwork and the brickwork starts falling off the school building because you're doing design and build, and there's no, you know, clerk of works or resident engineer making sure that you've got the right number of ties and you're doing the job properly and making sure the school doesn't fall down.
So are we talking about, we need somebody between the client and their supply chain who can crack the whip when they need to and basically act as a sort of overseer.
Always used to be.
Make sure that people are doing what they said.
Always used to be.
A new role then.
Well, no, it's an old role to introduce. It's an old role. It's a resident engineer. Okay.
But I was trying to segue into our next topic there.
But I see what you're doing.
There's clearly a role for somebody to sit just below the boss and keep an eye out for what's going on further down the chain.
Yes, I see where you're going, yes. Where are you going with this? I know where you're going. Our listeners don't, David.
Well, this is a topic that you noticed actually well before me. I hadn't noticed it at all. In fact, it's the
specific to Kia. This is Kia.
Yes, it's Kia. This is a story actually that you that you posted this week about the new Kia chief executive Stuart Togwell. Took over from Andrew Davis just back in the autumn, and he's sort of reorganised the sort of senior structure at Kia, and he's appointed various people. He's slimmed. I'm just going to paraphrase what you said in your opening paragraph, that he's slimmed down from 5 divisions to 3, appointed a chief operating officer, and various other people. Louise Finlay, currently chief people officer, is now chief operating officer, etc., etc. But to cut to the chase, the thing which you picked out of this was the appointment of somebody into a new role. This is the individual concerned is Abby Cook, who was previously head of strategy for Kia Places. She's now chief of staff to Stuart Togwell. And this is a new role, which you've pointed out. Other tier one contractors have adopted as well. Because, I mean, Mace now has a chief of staff. And various other, you know, leading contractors have a chief of staff.
No, not many. I could only find, when Mace did it in 2021, I noticed it because the person who was recruited to fill that job was a woman called Hannah Vickers, who was previously running the Association for Consultancy and Engineering. I still think of the Association of Consulting Engineers, but she was running that trade body, and she was recruited. And she wasn't Mace's chief of staff. She was specifically Mark Reynolds' chief of staff. Mm-hmm. And it struck me as, well, I'm not going to say how it struck me, but it struck me as it's curious. Anyway, she did that job for 3 years, and now she's been moved upwards and onwards within the Mace organisation, some other more sort of customer-facing role, I guess. And her replacement there is the former PR guy at Mace, a guy called David Hendy, who's a sort of a spin doctor type, who's also on the Labour Infrastructure Forum, so, you know, Politico as well. And I never quite understood what Mace wanted a chief of staff for. Anyway, when Kia, Stuart Togwell, who's not a new face at Kia, he was previously head of Kia Construction, and he sort of stepped up from head of Kia Construction to group CEO just in November, as you say. And he's decided to appoint himself a chief of staff. I went, another one? Is this a growing trend?
Yeah.
And I did a little sort of desk search, and I had completely forgotten, and we'd reported it, but it hadn't stayed in my consciousness, that when David Allen was chief executive of Waite Group, he appointed himself, he wanted a chief of staff, and he appointed Emily Westcott, now Emily Tate, as chief of staff. And as far as I can tell, Emily Tate is still chief of staff to the chief executive of Waite, although she's also, and probably more primarily, a financial director of Waite Construction, which I think is probably the sort of the day job. Because I kind of tried to look up what is a chief of staff. Incidentally, the Waite connection, I thought, was that because David Allen, when he left Waite as chief executive, he went to become finance director or CFO of Mace. And I thought, oh, did he take the chief of staff idea from Waite to Mace and tell Mark Reynolds? But no. Mark Reynolds had already got himself a chief of staff before David Allen arrived. But he may have seen what David Allen had done and thought, I like that idea. Not only am I going to steal that idea, I'm going to steal that person and get him over as my finance director. That's possible. Or maybe the two things are completely separate. But anyway, those were all a long time ago. 2019, Waite CEO appoints the chief of staff. 2021, Mace CEO appoints the chief of staff. And just this month, 5 years on, four and a half years on, Kia, new chief executive, appoints the chief of staff. So you can't exactly call it a snowballing, rushing trend. But I thought, is there something going on? And what is the chief of staff? Should other people have one? So I Googled it and I asked AI.
Of course, as you do.
Well, I actually Googled it, and what it said is, AI says, because that's what happens with Google.
Yes, that's right. Doesn't give you the... Yeah.
A chief of staff in business, I mean, we think of it as a military term, I think, normally. But
yes, exactly.
It's a senior executive supporting a CEO or top leader, acting as a strategic partner, project manager, and communication hub to boost executive effectiveness and organisational efficiency. Handling tasks ranging from strategic planning and execution to managing projects, resolving conflicts, and representing the leader in meetings. They filter information, manage workflows, and ensure the executive vision translates into actionable plans across departments. You think, well, isn't that a chief operating officer? Because Togwell at Kier has also just appointed a chief operating officer, which is a new role, as the HR person, or the chief people officer, as they call it at Kier. They've now got the dual role of chief people officer and chief operating officer. A lot of people have an HR chief and a COO as separate jobs.
Yeah.
And COO is essentially someone who runs the company day to day. Now, odd having HR running the company day to day, but when you and I talked about this, there are a lot of small businesses where the boss is the person who is running around trying to win business and fight fires and make sure the job's done right on sites or whatever. And the boss's, what used to be called secretary, is running the office. They're making sure that the photocopier's working, that people are turning up, that the holiday chart's sorted, that when someone's off sick, there's cover, that they might even be doing organising, they might not be making the recruitment decisions, but they're getting people in for job interviews, and they're effectively running the show. And it used to be, in the old days, small business, the secretary, who much sort of underrated term, although company secretary is bigger thing often, it's a lawyer.
Yes, it's a different role. Yeah.
So chief operating officer in a bigger company is sort of okay, they're not checking the photocopiers full, and people don't have photocopiers anymore, but they're essentially doing the day-to-day stuff, while the CEO is perhaps being more ambassadorial and putting their face about and making friends and influencing people. But so where does the chief of staff fit in with all of this?
I know because they don't have a strategic role. They don't sort of tell people what to do further down the line.
They don't have a team,
do they?
No,
they don't.
I think they just whisper things upwards. I think their job is Iago.
Well, all right then. I tell you, I thought about this and I thought I know what it is. He's a consigliere.
Yes, okay, much better.
He's like Silvio Dante in The Sopranos.
Okay, Robert Duvall.
Or Tom Hagen in The Godfather.
But Tom Hagen was consigliere, but that in corporate terms, that's the company secretary, the company lawyer.
Maybe
it's the company lawyer that the CEO actually isn't scared of and gets on with.
Yeah. Well, Silvio Dante wasn't a lawyer. He just ran a strip club, didn't he? But I thought maybe you could clarify your structure if you wanted to do that. And so your CEO could be the Don, and then you could have your chief of staff as a consigliere, and then all the other C-suite executives could be underbosses, and then middle management are all capos, and then you've got the soldiers out on the site. It's so much cleaner and clearer, where you stand. But I also did an AI search, but I Googled it and I asked what does a chief of staff do? And it says that it originates in the armed forces to describe a senior staff officer supporting a commander. But then it said that the title has expanded to include similar support roles in government, like the White House. I mean, obviously, you talk about White House chief of staff and business. And I think business, is just sort of filtered down into the corporate world now. And so we've got usually big organisations or organisations that think they're big and complex enough to justify the term adopting that as well. And you'll probably find that your SMEs will have a chief of staff before long.
I think some people might suspect there's an element of vanity on a chief executive who wants their own personal chief of staff. I mean, if the chief executive needs a chief of staff, why shouldn't the, you know, why shouldn't everyone have a chief of staff to do the grunt work they don't want to do?
Well, exactly. And I think there's probably a lot to be said. I'm sure there's a really good, somebody probably, you know, maybe a somebody from McKinsey or some other consultancy has said, you know, you're doing too much. Goes to a CEO and say, you're doing too much. You can't handle this workload. You need to offload some of it. And he said, well, I can't offload it to my chief operating officer because they've got their hands full at the moment. And my chief finance officer is trying to cook the books for the next financial results. So they say, well, create a new role, get yourself a chief of staff, and they can just sort of, you know, lighten the load a little bit. Maybe that's what it is.
See, what I would say if I saw a company CEO creating a new job, office next door to him or her, the chief of staff role, I kind of think, yeah, they'll obviously think good times ahead and they're in danger of getting, you know, fat and bloated as an organisation. But at the same time as standing accused of risking getting fat and bloated by creating COO and COS jobs, Keir has created three divisions of transportation, natural resources, nuclear networks have been merged into just one new division of infrastructure. Mm. So three divisions becoming one, which suggests a slimming down. So they're kind of slimming down just below the top or two below the top, but fattening up between the top and the middle.
Yeah. Well, there must be, I'm sure there's some unassailable logic behind it. But I mean, I think it looks to me as if it's just sort of a fashionable thing to do. You know, I mean, once upon a time,
it can't be that fashionable. If only three people in 6 years have done it, in 7 years have done it, wouldn't it?
Well, they're ahead of the curve. Yeah. Ahead of the curve. Everybody else will do it soon. I mean, I'm sure Balfour Beatty and Costain won't be too far behind. But
if Waite's chief of staff had a full-time chief of staff, and according to a LinkedIn profile, she's still chief of staff, but she's also finance director of Waite's Construction. Mm-hmm. If she's doing this chief of staff job, and then someone said, oh, yeah, can you go be finance director of the construction division as well, please? It couldn't have been that big a gig, because finance director of Waite Construction is a pretty full-time job, I'd imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, interesting. I mean, 20 years ago, there wasn't even such a thing as a chief executive officer, as far as I can remember. There was a managing director. You had your chairman, and below then was your managing director. But the managing director's role has changed since
then. Oh, I think you need to go back about 40 years ago for that, David, don't you?
Oh, do I? Okay. It's showing my age.
But you're right. In the olden days, if you were managing director, you were the boss.
Yeah.
Now it's a bit like your, you know, VP. A big American organization has got, you know, VP washrooms.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of this actually does come from the States quite clearly. You know, the presidents and vice presidents of American corporations have been around for a long time. We don't have them in this country, although I think I might have noticed one or two cropping up within the last few years.
They tend to be American
vice presidents.
They tend to be American subsidiaries or American
subsidiaries. Yeah.
But if I was made vice president of an organization, I'd be cock-a-hoop. But in many organisations, it means absolutely nothing until you're at least an executive vice president. And even then, you're not a senior vice president or a deputy vice president. Or I think probably deputy vice president might be below vice president. I'm not sure. Anyway,
I don't know.
I wonder what the most vice presidents any organisation has got. I bet some of the big American banks have got thousands.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, let's go and have a look at Caterpillar or somebody like that. They've probably got a few.
I'm looking it up. How many VPs has... No, let's go for big bank, Citibank.
Okay.
Oh, a specific number isn't available.
Oh, they're just too embarrassed to admit it. Maybe we should adopt military titles over here. I mean, if chief of staff is mob titles. Yeah, well, we could do. Mob title. I like the mob title idea. I think it's... CMA might have something to say about that, but I mean, why didn't Stuart Togwell call himself Field Marshal?
I think we've
got an established
Admiral sounds better.
Admiral, yes, let's go for naval naval.
But
ranks.
You know what? The one that surprises me is that these sort of right on companies call it chief of staff, but they would never dream of calling their colleagues staff. So it should be called chief of colleagues.
Yeah, that you're going back to HR. HR is
personnel.
A role which I think it's changed a lot, hasn't it? It used to be personnel. And I've always thought personnel does what it says on the tin. It's about the people in the organisation. Human resources sort of dehumanises
exactly. Yes,
people,
it does
really.
Sound like a step back, doesn't it? It's like going
yes, it
from
does.
Colleagues to staff. You know, yes. you're not our personnel. You're just a resource.
Yeah, a resource, yeah. But then it's come full circle. And now people are called chief people officers. I've seen chief people officer in various roles in the UK construction industry.
Well, that's what Keir has. That's what their new chief operating officer is.
She's
chief people
officer. Yeah, yeah. Which sounds a bit, I don't know, a bit clunky. I mean, personnel, I still like personnel. But chief people officer, I don't know. Yeah, it's better than human resources anyway.
Right.
Well, I think we'll see some more chiefs of staff appearing.
Yes, and we should make that clear. They are chiefs of staff, not chief of staffs.
Yes, not chief of staffs.
So I thought that was it. I still don't know what. I know what Emily Tate does at Waits. She looks after the finances of Waits Construction, which is the definite proper job. Whatever the chief of staff role is, what Hannah Vickers, now the PR chappy David Hendy, what they do. For Mark Reynolds, I've no idea. And what Abby Cook will be doing for Stuart Togwell, similarly, is a mystery to me.
Well, let's give the last word to AI then in that case, because according to my search, in civilian sectors, it's a versatile executive-level support function. Says it all, doesn't it?
Very helpful. Thank you. Now I know.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Right. We should have been getting our crystal ball out and looking to the year ahead, but I've just received the December Purchasing Managers Index report, which shows and still in negative territory. So my only prediction for 2026, getting way ahead of myself.
Yeah.
I have one prediction for 2026 is that at some point during the year, the construction PMI will finally get out of negative territory, which it didn't do in the entirety of 2025. I don't think it's ever been a year in negative territory. At some point in 2026, the PMI will get above 50. I will stake one of my T-shirts on it, but not much more.
Things can only get better.
Absolutely. Right, I'm off to invade Greenland. How about you?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to have a go at Venezuela myself. It's warmer down there.
Alrighty. Thank you for listening, everyone. Till next time, I've been Phil Bishop. He's been David Taylor. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.